Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, Juliet Fromholt brings you another selection from the Antioch Writers' Workshop. She'll also spotlight an interview with Alternative Radio's David Barsamian, taped right here in the WISO studios. And Emily McCord has this week's Politics Ohio. Up first, you're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WISO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us. On November 15th at the Dayton Art Institute, a new documentary film, produced and directed by Eileen LeBlanc, will have its Dayton premiere. The film is called Take Us Home. The film tells the stories of Ethiopian Jews and their quest for Israel. We'll talk a little bit more about the premise of the film. Joining me today are the two composers for the film score, Michael and Sandy Bashall, musicians and artists who have offered their talents to patrons around the world and here in the Miami Valley. Today we're going to talk a little bit about the film and their process for composing the music. Michael and Sandy, thanks so much for joining us.
Our pleasure.
So let's begin at the beginning of your involvement with the film. How were you approached?
Well, when we first heard of this film, it was from Karen Levin, director of the Levin Family Foundation, and she was in Ethiopia doing due diligence for her foundation. And she, you know, knew that this story was going on, that these folks were being transported back to Israel. She looked around, did a little research, and realized nobody was documenting it. And it was coming to the end of the process. And so she thought, you know, somebody should be documenting it. So she came back. She talked to us about it. And, well, I think she talked to Steve and Julia. And they recommended Eileen for this job. So did we. She hooked up with Eileen, and they started making trips to Ethiopia. And, boy, Eileen can tell you stories about this trip. They went four or five times?
Yeah, to both Ethiopia and Israel.
Right. And then Eileen tagged us for doing the music for her.
You mentioned Steve Bognar and Julia Reichert, and both have had wonderful, stellar careers. So they recommended Eileen, who has also done some fantastic work and has a real knack for storytelling. And did either of you get to make any trips?
We had hoped to, but because of funding, felt that it was more important that Eileen and Karen and Mike King, the videographer, go. That was a better investment. We asked them to collect samples of music from Ethiopia, not to directly copy, but to influence our approach. And also, we wanted to hear what some of the instruments sounded like from that region. And that all played into what we put together.
Your music was composed looking at clips from the film.
No, actually, we've done a lot of work with Eileen, and she likes to have music to edit too. So she'll tell us typically this scene is going to be about this topic. It has this sort of emotional quality, and that's what she wants the music to reflect. So we go home. And we work up some sketches, musical sketches, and send them to her. And she says yay or nay, faster or slower. And I like this instrument sound or this kind of sound. And we work on it that way. Then we give her, when she gives us time frames too, because she'll say I need X amount, 3 minutes here or a minute and a half there or whatever. That's sort of how our process
goes. Yeah, occasionally we will look at some clips, but
yes, after stuff gets done.
Yeah,
sure.
And then make sure that things seem to match up. And so we're part of that process too.
So in a film like this, it's got larger themes, some political themes as well, but it's mainly a story about the personal stories of the people involved in this operation. So you're composing off of moods and Eileen's direction as well.
And character, too. I mean, we actually use the names of some of the people involved as a melodic inspiration or a rhythmic inspiration for some of the songs.
Mm-hmm. And do we have an example of what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah, we do. We'll use Fakadu, who was his family turned out to be sort of a main focus. And she knew that. I mean, once they got there and started meeting people, you know, it emerged that his family was going to be sort of typical. And she described him to us. And then we did get to see footage of him. Mm-hmm. So we started with an original melody, which was a descending melodic line. And we can play a little bit of that. And then after Eileen heard that, it reminded her of something else too much. You know, it's in her head, it just sounded too much like something else. So we went back home and made an ascending melodic line and with less space, tightened it up a little bit. And we can play a little bit of that. After that, she wanted us to. It was after that she wanted us to tighten it up. Yes. Oh no.
No. She wanted us to leave more space.
She wanted more space in it.
So we did. We basically stretched out the timing. It was more of a call and response, with several bars in between.
And so the third version represents that musical, and that was the final.
Earlier, we talked about your request for Ethiopian music just to influence what you were doing. Do you have an example of how that worked?
Yeah, she brought us CDs back, and some of it was like house music, you know, like dance music. And what we were more interested in was, you know, the ethnic instruments. And let's see, they had horsehair fiddle they used that. And we've found that in a number of places, on a number of CDs, and I also some YouTube stuff, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a flute, an ethnic flute. And so we referenced those sounds with stuff that we have in our library. We dig through everything and find something that had that feeling and that tone.
Let's talk about now that you've finished the process, the movie is about to premiere. Is it what you expected, or is the end of the journey completely different from what you were, or did you have any idea?
About 4 years ago. This has been a four-year process, so we've watched it change, and even the concept of the film evolve and change. Certainly the final cut is not what the original what the first cut was. I mean, it's gone through some yeah. storyline changes even.
But as far as our, I don't think I had any real preconception about what it was going to be like.
We trust Eileen's judgment an awful lot. She's great. She's great, a great storyteller, and her powers of editing are really remarkable. So our point of view is that the music serves the film. It's not made to draw attention to itself. You know, you want it to propel the story.
Yeah, that's it.
Michael and Sandy, so the premiere is coming up on the 15th. Are you excited?
Right. Oh, yeah. Yes, absolutely. Eileen has arranged for some of the Ethiopians to be at the premiere. Fakati, who's the song, you know, that we're leaving with you, that we played, he'll be there. His son, Worku, and Orly, who is also a filmmaker, and she was Eileen's translator. And she was, you know, worked on the film while they were overseas. And I can't wait to meet these people.
Yeah. And we've watched them age, you know, over the course of 4 years. Worku was, I think, 15 when Eileen went over there. And now he's a young man. So,
he speaks, well, whatever his language was there. Was it Aramaic in Ethiopia? And now he speaks Hebrew and English.
Yeah.
And in like 4 years, he's an amazing kid. I just can't wait to see him. It really will be a nice event. There's a little reception ahead of time, and then the film. And the film's about an hour long. Questions and answers afterwards, and then I think the crew will be out in the rotunda afterwards if people want to, you know, stop and say hello.
I'm speaking with Michael and Sandy Bashall. They have composed the music for a new film from Eileen LeBlanc called Take Us Home. The premiere is November 15th at the Dayton Art Institute. The film has actually already been well received by critics.
Yeah, it's won an editing award overseas. God, I'm forgetting.
Amsterdam International Film Festival.
Yeah, it's out there. They started sending it out to festivals in late spring. In the meantime, you know, once that was finished, then we did, gosh, a number of radio things with mm-hmm. Eileen mm-hmm. and those pieces for the Historical Society. And
well, you're on to other projects, and let's just touch on some of those before we leave you. Michael, you just finished a sculpture.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's called I Can Make You Dance, and the Dayton Phoenix Project, Citywide Development, commissioned me to create this work for the North Dayton Triangle, Salem and Catalpa, and that's where the old Troutman Studios were. There, it's now a park. The site of the old studios is now a park, and they wanted this sculpture to both represent the Dayton Triangle area and also be somewhat of a tribute to Roger Troutman. And so they wanted it to be a musical sculpture. So I gave him 27 triangles and 6 clock chimes in a pentatonic scale that was based on one of the songs that Roger wrote called I Can Make You Dance. And so those delicately chime in, you know, as
in
if distant bells. Right. Yeah, they sound like distant bells. So mm-hmm. I felt real good about it.
Well, great. I bet they were put to the test.
They certainly were the day we installed it.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, great. And what about musically? What are you working on now?
You know, we play. I'll tell you where we play. We play once a month, first Friday, at Jay's Restaurant down in Dayton's Oregon District. Amy, the owner, just signed us up for the entire year of 2013. And we'll be there on first Fridays, except in the months that have Urban Nights, and then we'll be there on Urban Nights.
Yeah.
And it's a nice scene.
We'll be there.
It's a beautiful room. Yeah. It's a great, fun bunch of people come out there. And
we play that with our group, Puzzle Flight, with John Taylor and Eric Reith and Richard Roll joining us. And an occasional person sitting in, too. So it's always fun.
Michael and Sandy Bashall, thanks for your art and music, and thanks for speaking with us today.
Thanks for having us. It's nice to see you.
The Dayton premiere of Eileen LeBlanc's documentary Take Us Home is November 15th at the Dayton Art Institute. This is WISO Weekend.
This is Juliet Frumholt with this week's reading from the Antioch Writers' Workshop. Today we hear from Carrie Bebris, an award-winning author best known for her Mr. and Mrs. Darcy series. Here she reads from The Chase, a short story based on the real-life adventures of Jane Austen's brother while he served in Britain's Royal Navy.
Lieutenant Glover's greetings, Captain, and the watch has spotted sails approaching from the northwest. Francis William Austen set down the letter he had been reading when the midshipman entered his cabin. The remains of his breakfast lay pushed aside on the small dining table, awaiting clearance by the steward. He had eaten late, having gone on deck shortly after rising to observe a French brig that had come into their sights yesterday, and that had escaped a volley of British fire by taking refuge under the cover of a battery on shore. After assuring himself in the hazy morning light that their chase had not managed to sneak past them during the night, and giving orders to set a northeast by north course that kept their quarry in view, Austen had returned to his cabin to reread the latest dispatches over a lukewarm meal of ham and porridge. Fortunately, the coffee held its heat, and he had just poured a second cup from the pot to combat the chill of the day's early spring gales. How many? Three, sir. The junior officer's eyes were bright, his face eager. At 14, he saw every foreign sail as a potential opportunity to make his fortune or distinguish himself for promotion while advancing the cause of the crown. In truth, so did most of the Royal Navy. And the brig? Still skulking along shore. Thank you, Mr. Phillips. Tell Mr. Glover that I shall join him on the forecastle directly. Left to himself once more, Captain Austen indulged in a last sip of coffee before rising from the table to resume his coat. It hung from a peg near one of the two cannons that dominated the cabin's sides, an ever-present reminder that despite the relative luxury of his accommodations compared to those of the rest of the ship's company, he was nevertheless aboard a sloop of war. The Petterel was a fast, reliable vessel of 16 guns, 24 if one included the 8 carronades mounted on the quarterdeck and forecastle. At full complement, she carried 121 men, boys, officers, and Marines, trained and disciplined to exacting standards with measurable results. Last June, they had proved their merit and valor as part of a fleet action under Vice Admiral Lord Keith, in which they captured a French squadron of 5 ships of the line near Toulon. Now, on blockade duty in the Western Mediterranean Sea, the Petterel was under general orders to intercept any vessel that came in her path, whether naval or private, thus crippling French commerce and thwarting Napoleon's attempts to supply and reinforce the army he had left behind in Egypt. Austen hoped the Petterel would prove the making of him, the means by which he would rise from a mere commander addressed as captain out of courtesy to a post-captain, title, right epaulette, and all. Making post was the most significant promotion of a naval officer's career, the date from which the seniority that determined all further advancement was established. A full captain could command larger ships for better pay, frigates and ships of the line, perhaps serve as a flag captain to an admiral. Until that day came, however, Austen was content to command the Petterel to the best of his ability to carry out his duty, knowing that the smaller engagements of his sloop contributed to the greater efforts of the war that all in His Majesty's Navy strove and sacrificed to win. As he adjusted the single epaulette on his left shoulder and smoothed dark blue lapels over his white waistcoat, his gaze strayed to the letter he had been reading when the midshipman interrupted him. My dear Frank, I just today received your letter of July 27th and expect this reply will be more traveled than you by the time you read it. The missive had been forwarded to him along with the dispatch packet he had received last evening and was from Jane, his younger sister and most faithful correspondent. Separated by little more than a year in age, they shared the dark eyes and slender nose common to the Austen family. But more important, they shared a determination to stay in contact as best they could, despite the obstacles of distance and war. Other family members wrote him as well, but Jane's tidings were rendered with sharp observation and wit that was uniquely hers. The letters often took months to find him and sometimes arrived out of order, but he treasured every one, for they were his connection to the people with whom he was not Captain Austen, but Frank, and to the home he had left when not quite 12 to enter the Naval College at Portsmouth. Now just 1 month shy of 26, he had already served in the Navy more than half his life. Frank put away Jane's closely written pages, and with them thoughts of the family he had not seen since before taking command of the Petterel in Gibraltar 13 months earlier. More urgent matters demanded his attention. The letter joined others in his sea chest, which, like all of the room's furniture, would be removed to the hold if the decks were cleared for action. the dispatches he secured on his person in an inner pocket of his coat. From the windows of his cabin beneath the quarterdeck, he could not see the sails Mr. Glover had reported, but he could hear the north wind, which blew strong today. With full canvas, the unknown vessels could be within range of the Petterel before noon. He reached for his hat and settled the bicorn over dark hair worn closely cropped in a futile attempt to control its curls in the Mediterranean humidity. Captain Austin once more, he headed for the door. Three ships. If friendly, they and the Petterel would exchange news. If not, they would exchange fire. Thank you.
That was Carrie Bebras reading an excerpt from her short story, The Chase, during last summer's Antioch Writers' Workshop. The book Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism, is a collection of interviews with economist Richard Wolff from David Barsamian, host of Alternative Radio, which airs Wednesday nights at 11 here on WYSO. Barsamian recently visited Yellow Springs and spoke with Andy Valeri, host and producer of Uncommon Sense TV Media and occasional co-host of Around the Fringe here on WYSO. Here's an excerpt from that interview.
You know, as you talk about the analysis that you do on capitalism, I think you have a very sort of special perspective on it because of your lengthy history in covering this and the fact that you have much of your journalism and much of your coverage has been global. I mean, you've been traveling the world for decades now, and you've spent time in India, Pakistan, Asia, you know, the Middle East, et cetera. So you've seen the actual face of capitalism on a global scale in the work, and where somebody here might think, well, this is my pizza joint that I'm running my business, and I'm an entrepreneur, and I'm trying to...
A job creator.
Right, you know, and they're thinking, you know, I don't want the government on my back, et cetera, et cetera. Those are all fine and realistic principles, but what you're really dealing with here isn't that. You're dealing with something completely different.
No, the capitalists don't want the government on their back when they're making money. But when they're losing money, they want the government on their backs. That's the bank bailouts.
Right.
That's saving Goldman Sachs, which should be, you know, many of its officers probably should be prosecuted for crimes against the American people and the environment. Mm-hmm. So they feign this kind of aloofness from government. But when push comes to shove, government bail me out, you know. I'm too big to fail. We got sold out, they got bailed out, is the slogan of the Occupy movement.
The adage, the sort of running joke about socialism
for the rich.
The rich and privatization for the poor.
This is extreme in the American economy. Let's talk about sports, you know, a topic I'm very interested in. Professional sports teams, which are private enterprises, frequently go to town councils or state governments and say, hey, we need a new stadium. We need improved infrastructure. We need highways, bridges. We need to, you know, get our fans to the stadium. We need luxury boxes, et cetera, et cetera. And the implication, not explication, is that if this is not provided, we will move somewhere else. Like the Cleveland Browns left Cleveland, Ohio, to go to Baltimore, Maryland, where they were given these kinds of facilities. Now, Arthur Modell was not a poor person. Quite wealthy, the owner of the Cleveland Browns, just to give you one example. Or Jim Irsay, you know, who moved the Baltimore Colts to Indianapolis because he got a stadium, he got a deal. They get tax breaks, they have all kinds of loopholes and direct taxpayer supported subsidies. They're getting, in many instances, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in order to make money. You know, this money is not repaid to the state or municipal treasuries. When profits are made by these professional sports teams, and they're very profitable enterprises, the management keeps it. The owners keep it, and the dividends go to the stockholders.
Right.
This is really existing capitalism, not the capitalism that's taught at economics departments at, you know, Dayton University or at OSU in Columbus. And that's the capitalism, the imagined capitalism. Then there's the real capitalism on the ground, which heavily depends on state subsidies and state protection.
Andy Valeri speaking with alternative radio host David Barsamian about his new book of interviews with Richard Wolff. It's called Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism. You can hear alternative radio Wednesday nights on WYSO beginning at 11 o'clock. For more of this interview, visit us online at wyso.org.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Emily McCord. Now that the election is over, we look to what's next for President Obama's second term in office. And I'm joined today by Bill Hershey. He's a political reporter, and he's covered every Ohio presidential election here since 1980. Thanks for being here today.
Oh, it's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about the fiscal cliff. It has major implications for the Miami Valley and Ohio in general because of those possible looming defense cuts. Can we just start out, what could this mean for our area?
Well, from what I've read, we have 27,000 jobs at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and then 10,000 or more that are connected to the base. Some of these jobs could be lost if we go over the fiscal cliff. And this would reverberate through the Miami Valley economy. It wouldn't be just limited to the base, but it would be our whole economy is impacted largely by Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
We spoke earlier in the week, and you said that the president's a great campaigner, but less so at bringing people together. What is the president going to have to do to help this Congress reach a deal?
The president has to get with the congressional leaders, and they have to find common ground. He has more freedom to do this now that he's been reelected because he won't be on the ballot again. He's really, if he's campaigning for anything now, he's campaigning for a legacy that brought the American economy back to strength and ended the partisan bickering. He talked in his first campaign about we're not a red America, we're not a blue America, we're red, white, and blue, or we're all Americans. Well, this is his chance to do that. And he has to show more resolve, I think, than he did in his first term. No question that the Republicans were recalcitrant, didn't want to deal with him, but somehow he has to be willing to lock them in a room together with him until they come up with a deal and find that common ground without giving up on his principles.
So how is that going to happen? I mean, we remember how the 2011 negotiations went. It seemed like they had found a lot of common ground, and then Speaker of the House John Boehner pulled out at the last minute. How is this going to be different this time around?
I think the difference, as I said, is that the president's not running for reelection, but we don't know if it's going to be different for the Republicans because we did think there was a deal between the president and Speaker Boehner, but to his right, members of the Tea Party caucus, others who were more conservative than Speaker Boehner said, no, we won't make a deal. And we don't know if the Republicans are going to be willing to move a little bit themselves toward the president this time. Because we have to remember, the Republicans in the House, they're still in charge, and they have a very substantial majority. And perhaps many of them don't think there is any need to make a deal. This will be a test of leadership for Speaker Boehner as well as a test of leadership for President Obama.
So where does that leave us? You know, if the two can work together, then something might happen. But what if that doesn't happen?
If it doesn't happen, we could go over the cliff at least for a few days. In fact, one of the president's supporters, columnist Paul Krugman of the New York Times, has said the president should be willing to go over the cliff at least for a short time if it means sticking to his principles. And Krugman's point of view was that if that happens, it will shock the Republicans into coming into agreement with the president. We've got a month and a half or so until the end of the year. You know, maybe they'll get in the holiday spirit as we near Christmas and the New Year, and they'll want to give each other a gift, and a gift to the American people as well.
Shifting gears here for just a moment, there's been a lot of post-game analysis about the election. Regarding the demographic shift that has been favoring Democrats and perhaps cost the Republicans the election, Ohio is always an important swing state to win. How does Ohio's changing demographic play into the politics here, and what does that portend for future campaigns?
Well, I think Ohio is a little bit different than some of the states where the demographics in terms of ethnicity had a big effect. In a state like Colorado, for example, the growing Latino population benefited President Obama. We have Latino, Hispanic voters in Ohio, but not in as great a number as they do in some of these other swing states. In our state, it was actually the Obama campaign's ability to call on those same people who voted for President Obama the last time to come out and vote for him again. The Republicans, I think, were shocked that the Obama campaign was able to generate the same kind of enthusiasm it generated 4 years ago.
If demographics are indeed changing, will Ohio remain as crucial of a swing state as it has in the past?
As crucial, I'm not sure. We've lost two electoral votes, but one thing is true, just as it was this time. No Republican has ever been elected president without carrying Ohio, and I think particularly for Republicans, they will have to carry it 4 years from now.
I've been speaking with Bill Hershey. Thanks so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you. Good to talk with you.
That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org, a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.